Welcome to the special edition of Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. As many of you know, KUAC and nonprofit organizations are reeling from budget cuts or jeopardized funding. Live theater, it turns out, is no exception.
This goes back to our most basic needs and impulses as people, is to be around that campfire, to be in the presence of the great storyteller.
Fairbanks Drama Association's Peggy McDonald Ferguson discusses the value of her art. Also, in order for live theater to remain relevant, playwrights have to hold a mirror up to nature.
After the theater empties out, there'll be a big Ford pickup outside revving the engine, and a gentleman will come in and say, "That's me. That's my life."
Former state writer laureate Ann Hanley and Chris Lott looks at theater jargon. You share the limelight on this edition of Northern Soundings. I talked earlier this month with Peggy McDonald Ferguson about her life in and passion for live theater. Peggy is executive director at Fairbanks Drama Association. Much of our discussion centered on why live performances matter in an age of mega movies and hundreds of channels of video and audio content. I began by asking for her, when did the theater bug bite?
In college, when I was at the University of Minnesota, I was in two performing groups that I enjoyed immensely. I came from a very small farming community of 900 people, and so very few wonderful cultural experiences in that little town. And at college, I joined a madrigal singing group, which I just loved. It was an a cappella madrigal group, mixed men and women. And I enjoyed performing very much and blending with an ensemble, which is my greatest joy. And then I was in the theater department. I was accepted into the theater department, and I had the opportunity to work all the positions of production, from backstage to stage management to lighting design, set design, sound, acting. And then I was in two productions that really stole my heart, and they both happened to be musicals. And the first one was Carnival. Hi, Lily, hi, Lily, hi, Lo. And then the second one was the Threepenny Opera, the Bertolt Brecht. And I was totally gone. I was a goner.
Did your family get their eyebrows raised that you went into theater?
Well, my father was worried that I wouldn't find work, and was hoping maybe for a more practical study, field of study, but they always supported me. And then, of course, I also took a teaching degree for secondary education, so I always had that as a fallback. But then who knew I would fall in love with that career and was able to teach, you know, teenagers for 7 years here in the North Star Borough School District. That's how I came here.
What a wonderful segue, because, of course, when you came up in 69, you immediately started teaching. And it wasn't at Lathrop to begin with, was it? It was at Ryan?
Yes, Ryan Junior High had just been built, and it was the inaugural opening year of Ryan Junior High. And so that was my first teaching position in the district. And I immediately put in it for a transfer to Lathrop High School, because my favorite age group are juniors, 16-year-olds, because they're so open-minded. And that's just my favorite age of human being as far as maturation and readiness goes. And then I was very fortunate. My transfer went through, and I got to teach at Lathrop.
And you almost immediately started putting on dramatic productions, right?
Right. And because, wow, on the faculty at Lathrop at that time was Jean DeWild, who I immediately became fast friends. And we collaborated along with Gaynor Trammer, the choir director. The three of us got into putting on an annual musical as a team, with Jean designing all the sets and all the costumes and the lights, and Gaynor directing the music, and myself doing the staging and choreography. So we had some wonderful shows at Lathrop as a collaborative team.
You were also at performing at this time, too, weren't you?
I was. I really loved working with Lee Salisbury at the University of Alaska Theater Department. And I was in two musicals that Lee directed, Man of La Mancha, which opened the brand new Salisbury Theater, and then a subsequent production of Three Penny Opera. So it was a thrill to work with Lee.
Well, I know you got accolades for your performances. So what do you recommend an actor do to get a vivid and powerful performance?
What's critical to being a good actor is understanding rhythm. I think rhythm is at the core of all acting. The rhythm of the language, the rhythm of beats. I think to study music really prepares one to be an actor, because there's the discipline and the math of how many beats per measure, how many measures long is this phrase, how does this phrase work with the next phrase, what's the transition, is there a bridge? These are musical skills and understandings that absolutely, I think, are vital to be in the tool bag. It's so much fun to work with actors who can discuss in those terms, like if we're looking at a specific monologue, you know, and trying to look at the arc of that monologue and where does it start rhythmically? What is the time signature? Does the rhythm change? Do the colors and tones change? Of course, not every actor has that training, but I think if they do, they're able to express it more vividly through that lens, through the lens of understanding music and rhythm.
Talk to me a little bit about collaboration, because you talked about Gene DeWile, for example, and that give and take.
Well, that theater is all about collaboration. It's all about building an ensemble, a team that works together. And, you know, I'm a disciple of the great theater teacher, Uta Hagen. And she's written a great book, many books, but my favorite of hers is called Respect for Acting. And she posits that acting is listening. And to collaborate with somebody, you really have to listen to them full focus, not your mind doing three different things at one time, not your mind thinking, what do I say next? Or what? Not your mind going, how shall I reply? And that the genuineness of acting comes from total, open, and honest listening. And so collaboration, to me, is a function of that. I think that if people really, truly listen, they are already collaborating.
We've been talking a little bit about musical theater, and it's been observed that it's among the most expensive art forms to successfully mount, and it has so many elements in play that it's really the most challenging theatrical production to bring to audiences. Why do you like musical theater? Because you seem to thrive on that.
I do. I love musical theater, probably because it is the most challenging. And I've also staged operas, which are great. But my favorite to stage is always musical theater. It gives the full range of the human voice a performance platform. Not just the speaking voice, and not just the physicality that you find in regular theater, but you then get to sing. So it's another vocal dynamic of theater that to me makes full utilization of the human voice, which is my thing. I'm a voice person, and I love to see 100% utilization. Not only do they speak, but they sing. As an audience member, you really connect emotionally with people, with actors who are able to speak and sing. It's just my preference. Although I adore regular theater, meaning, you know, comedies, and of course dramas are just really tough to do, to make that truth live. When I directed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest a few years ago, wow, that was quite a process. You know, it was a huge cast, mostly men, set in, you know, the institution in Oregon known as the Cuckoo's Nest. And it was a mental ward for mental patients. And talk about a tragic story, a very psychologically complicated piece to do. And so I just came back to, if you want to be authentic and in the moment as an actor, you have to receive. You can't just give. You have to receive. You're a receiver, as important as you are a giver. And that's where the authenticity of performance comes.
I've always valued your sense of presence and polished delivery. When you get community members together who may or may not have experience, Peggy, how do you instill discipline and this creative and rhythmic and metrical quality?
Well, it's a lot of teaching. You know, what the director does, their job, the director's job is to teach the show. So there's a lot of teaching here, teaching and coaching for movement, physicality, voice, you know, intent, understanding of the character's arc. A good director teaches a show and is a good teacher and coach. And I think that's true in professional theater, though, too. You know, professional actors love getting strong feedback from their directors. They love working for directors they can respect and want to please. You're not working with them because you want them to please you. You're working with them because you want them to be the best that they can be. No sloppiness. Everything crisp as possible.
This is Northern Soundings, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Peggy McDonald Ferguson, Executive Director of Fairbanks Drama Association. When we return from the break, the kindness of friends. Speaking of which, it's Pledge Week at KUAC. Local programming like Northern Soundings is made possible by your generosity. Go to KUAC.org to learn more. This is Northern Soundings. This episode, I'm speaking with Peggy McDonald Ferguson, Executive Director of Fairbanks Drama Association. Peggy has a long history in teaching and directing shows in Fairbanks, but in the 1980s, she moved to Anchorage to work professionally. Let's return to our conversation.
There were many theater opportunities down there, and Anchorage is a bigger demographic, and there was lots of money to raise, and it was so easy to do.
And you helped start their light opera theater, right?
I was co-founder of the Alaska Light Opera Theater. I also staged productions for the Opera Anchorage. And I worked with the Anchorage Community Theater and the Out North Theater. It was fun to work professionally, but it was really a piece of cake. We don't have professional theater here in Fairbanks. All our people are volunteers. You know, our actors, our technicians, our support staff, everybody's a volunteer. Nobody does it for the money. You know, it's all done for love. And it's a harder fundraising environment in Fairbanks than in Anchorage. And we have so few corporate offices here. The headquarters are always in Anchorage. It's really tough. So we come to rely on individuals. They are the biggest donors in Fairbanks for gifts to the performing arts organizations in this town. We're very lucky because we just don't have the corporate support base here. But it's very difficult in Fairbanks to produce this. And, you know, I always will say, I stand on the edge and say, I made theater in Fairbanks. You can't imagine how hard that was.
Well, let's do a slight detour and ask, in those days, of course, there were more state funds for the arts as well as corporate donations. How important are state funds towards a community's artistic vitality?
Well, you know, they're quite important, and it's a stimulus. It's a good housekeeping seal. To apply for a grant from the State Arts Council as a nonprofit community arts organization, you go through a very rigorous application process, writing justification narratives, justification budgets, projections, justification of artistic and educational programming. It's a very rigorous process. And then a panel is picked from statewide arts experts, and they decide how to award the grants. And the grants You know, the largest grant given to an organization is $21,000. For example, Fairbanks Drama Association and Children's Theater, our grant award this year is $8,000, which again is not $8 million or $800,000 or $80,000. It's $8,000, but it's very meaningful. Again, it goes back to collaboration. You know, I'm really proud here at Fairbanks Drama Association that we are supported by the Alaska State Council on the Arts. It means we've gone through the process. We're recognized as a bona fide organization that serves our community and educates children. And we have that stamp of approval.
And you've served on the Alaska State Council on the Arts. How long has been that association, Peggy?
Well, you serve because of the governor appoints you to serve. It's an 11-member council. And the first governor who appointed me was Steve Cooper. So in the last, since then, I've been appointed by six governors to serve on the State Arts Council as a council member. That's been my volunteer work for the state of Alaska. And I'm very interested in help develop, you know, education programs and help organizations thrive throughout our gigantic state. And I'm very proud of that work.
Has your fundraising chops improved over time? Talk to me about that piece of the job.
Well, you know, I if I could choose, I would choose not to be a fundraiser. But that's, you know, how I make my living as part of my job here, among other duties. And I'm motivated to do that, to fundraise like crazy, because it keeps the venue going so we can make the art for the community and the community can make the art.
Is it easier these days or is it harder?
Oh, that's so difficult to judge. You know, fundraising is all based really on relationships. Friends support friends. And if our audience members, individuals, enjoy their experience here, they're going to feel generous. And so the more people we can bring in and get to enjoy the experience, the more generous the community will be. I have to believe that or I couldn't do this. I think that we're seeing that on an individual basis, even though, you know, corporate support is not what it used to be. So I can't say whether it's more difficult or less difficult. It's always a slog. It's always required. Every production has an expense budget. There's no business like show business, but you can't do it without the dough. And hopefully people will feel generous and gracious and want a little, give a little more than the price of their ticket to think this is a worthwhile project.
After 5 years, you returned to Fairbanks. When you came back, you've played important roles in both Fairbanks Light Opera Theater and Fairbanks Drama Association. What productions were you a part of that stand out in your mind?
Well, that's really hard. There were such wonderful shows. You know, in 1975, I directed My Fair Lady, and Bucky Wright and Don Nelson, who's since passed, arranged for us to tour it to Point Barrow. And there had never been a live performing arts show. And we flew the whole orchestra. Gordon Wright was my music director. I loved Gordon. I loved working with him. Now there's a great collaborator, and sorry he's gone. We flew the whole company, a cast of 40 and an orchestra of 25, to Barrow, and we set it up in the high school gymnasium, and the whole town came. And it was kind of theater in the round because we had backdrops, and you know, the audience was in the bleachers in the front. But then during Act One, all the kids started creeping towards the stage. This was phenomenal. And all of a sudden, they were surrounding in a circle the whole playing area. And at one point, Eliza Doolittle, played by Teresa Reed, was sitting on the sofa doing The Rain in Spain with the wonderful Robert Howard as Henry Higgins. And all of a sudden, there were two beautiful little Eskimo children, like a three-year-old and a four-year-old, sitting right beside her on the sofa. Right there in the scene. I mean, it was one of the most fantastic things I've ever seen. Well, talk about participatory theater. It was outstanding. It was like, I thought, if I died right now, I'd be a happy woman, because I had this great experience. They loved it. The town, the whole town was there. They loved it. All the guys from the Naval Research Lab were there. They loved it. It was a huge crowd. And how thrilling to perform My Fair Lady at the top of the world, where never had been a musical theater production live performed in that community.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Peggy McDonald Ferguson, Executive Director of Fairbanks Drama Association and Children's Theater. You heard her discuss the importance of personal patronage. And it's Pledge Week here at KUAC. During the break, take a moment to go online at KUAC.org and learn more. You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This episode, I'm talking with Peggy McDonald Ferguson, Executive Director of Fairbanks Drama Association. It's been observed community theater is under siege these days. It's a view shared by Peggy. Let's get back to our conversation.
I'm really worried about the future of live theater because of the digital age we're in. People aren't connected if they're looking at a screen. People aren't interacting really, you know, human to human if they're doing it on a screen. And nothing can replace that human to human outreach of art and love. It's being in the room at the same time immediately as a storyteller. This goes back to our most basic needs and impulses as people, is to be around that campfire, to be in the presence of the great storyteller, to be right there, to hear the quality of the voice, to watch the facial expressions, not through any kind of lens, but immediately through your own eyes and your own ears and your own physical receptors. And it's so important. Live theater is so important. It humanizes people. It opens them up to all forms of collaboration. It teaches them to think about story and story arc. It teaches them to think about the values in their own morality system as compared to the society at large. It's so important. And then plus, it's just simply totally consuming and entertaining. It's a value we cannot lose.
What are the challenges of keeping a company like Fairbanks Drama Association going in hard times, Peggy?
You know, it's always a challenge. And we rely on individuals to give donations in addition to buying theater tickets. The main thing that I work the hardest on is audience development and getting people into the theater. They can come once, they'll love it, and they'll come back if they'll just try. So I look for supporters among those patrons who come to us and love our product. And they love seeing their friends and neighbors on stage, and they come to appreciate how much work goes into this to make this such a great evening.
It seems to me we've lost touch with the role the audience must play in a production. And audience members come in not just to absorb, but they really are a dynamic element in a live production.
They're one of the players, always. The audience is a player in the cast. They're part of the story because they make the story circle complete. You can't do live theater without an audience. There has to be somebody out there to receive and give back. That's the function of the audience, and the actors, you know, need to build that relationship with a big room of perhaps all strangers, build that relationship, draw them into the story, ask them to receive what they're saying, and to give feedback. And that's either through, you know, you can hear audiences when they're responding. They sigh. We're very tuned in to audience responses, not just, you know, all of a sudden they start clapping because they like something. That's great. But they need to complete the circle. We can't do theater, live theater, without an audience. And that's why audience development is so important. They need to come help us tell this story.
The final piece of cultivation is, I think, about 8x10 and Looking Glass Theater. Why is it important to cultivate playwrights?
Well, playwrights are the backbone of the theater. Without them, there is no theater. They create the text. They tell the story that then needs to be brought to full life on stage in front of real living people. And I think that there has been a surge in the last 10 years or so in America. And we're glad here in Fairbanks to play a part in that. I'm very pleased to have been a part in developing Looking Glass Group Theater, giving opportunities to emerging and established playwrights in the state of Alaska, because it's so hard to get your piece produced when it's brand new and nobody knows you and nobody knows your work. And you know, what a lonely job playwriting. You're writing the story that is to be performed by this company of people that are in your mind at this point only. And for it to come to life, it has to be produced. It has to go from the page to the stage. And that's a rough calling to be a playwright. And how fun, though, to work with a playwright in the house when you're doing a new work, because they get to hear their words spoken for the first time in the music of their language, and they can make revisions as they go, and it's like a living document. I love working when the playwright is in the house with a brand new work. And I had the opportunity to do that with Anne Hanley, because I always tell my actors when we start rehearsals, look, we're true to the text. It's like the playwright is sitting in the fourth row, and we are true to this text. We don't paraphrase. We don't change it. We're serving the playwright. That's our job, to serve the playwright. That's one of my first rules, right? And so how fun to have Anne Hanley, the playwright, when we did the Sunset Clause here at Fairbanks Drama Association, a full-length comedy of Anne's, to have Anne there. And then she'd go away and she'd think about the rehearsal and she'd come back to me with notes and say, I want to change this because you made me see this and I want to do this. And or she would say, I like this, I don't like that. Here's not what I meant. And maybe I wasn't clear, or maybe you're taking it in the wrong direction. It was one of the most intellectually challenging, wonderful times I've ever had, to be able to have the living playwright in the room. While we were rehearsing the play.
And what a playwright.
Oh, she's terrific. Yeah. She is so clever. She's so darkly funny and so in touch with everybody, her own and everybody's mortality, but in a really darkly funny way. And what do you got to do? You got to, you know, whistle past the graveyard and laugh at the end and laugh at the Grim Reaper. Because it's coming for all of us, and
no one gets out alive.
No one gets out alive, and that's Anne, you know, no one gets out alive. Her work is just, to me, so funny, so dark, and so thoughtful.
The final piece that we haven't talked about, that is a big aspect of Fairbanks Drama Association, is venue. For years, it had the Gaffney Street Theater, and then it would try to find a place at the Pioneer Park Civic Theater or this place and that. And what does it mean having a building? Because it really ties you down with expenses too, right?
Yeah, and in a way, that's a total blessing. You know, to have our own venue here at Fairbanks Drama, the Hap Writer Riverfront Theater, is a huge blessing, even though it comes with so many responsibilities and headaches. For example, we just re-roofed the building, and we bought a new furnace for the building, and we're always doing upgrades and maintenance. There's always that part of it. But the deal is, it's ours. It belongs to the community. And nobody can tell us where we can't put a screw or a nail. And nobody can charge us for accidental damages. If we cross the problem, we have to fix it. And it doesn't restrict our set building and our usage of space. It doesn't, there's no, you know, governmental controls like there would be through the school district or the borough or the city. You may use this facility only under these terms. How nice to be freed of that long list of terms. And we have our own space. And that is, we're so lucky, we're so rich. Even though it's a headache and it's expensive, I just think it's so worth it because it's an actual physical home. People can come here and feel they are home. I just think you can't replace that. And hopefully it keeps wagging and waving forever.
You also cultivate young audience and participants. And I think that must be important, right? Because you're growing a new generation.
That's the feeder program. That's the new wave. That's who's going to be here fundraising next in a row, are these wonderful young people from starting at age 5 through 18 who are intimately involved either with drama project classes or with the Young Playwrights Institute workshops, who get hooked in here and love it and find themselves and find their voice and realize that this is home. So we have, that's how we keep it going. It's generational.
Finally, you're the biggest winner of ACFest First Places. And I guess I should say ACFest is a statewide theater event. Communities around the state come together and show their best. And you've won more than anyone else. 6 times.
Well, you know, sadly, ACFest is no more because of lack of corporate, mainly corporate funding, where community theaters from all over Alaska would come to Haines, which has a wonderful theater facility. They own their own theater there. It's beautiful right on the ocean. And it was a biennial, every 2 years, theater festival, and it was a competition. And their professional adjudicators were brought in. And the categories were best director, best actor, best actress, best backstage teamwork, best overall production. And everybody was vying for those prizes against people from all over the state. It was so exciting. It was one of my favorite things to do because you got to meet people who were doing in their communities what you're doing in your own. And yeah, you know, so what? So I won 6 times. You know, best director. It's fun because I feel a little validated by it because it wasn't just in my community, you know, famous in Fairbanks, but I got validated on a statewide level, which was fun, which means you're doing something right and it motivates you, of course.
What's ahead for Peggy? Just making sure the next season keeps going?
You know, I recently told my board of directors, I have a great board of directors here at Fairbanks Drama Association, wonderful people. And I told them, you know, I have no intention of retiring. You know, I have no children, I have no grandchildren, I don't travel, I have no hobbies. What I have is a theater. And I'm just going to stay here until I drop in my traces. Because this is my passion. What else would I do? It keeps me young. It keeps me ticking along. You know, that's the irony of it all, isn't it? That's why I know there's a great God of the universe, because of the sense of humor there. When you're young, you have this beautiful, tight little body, right? But this unformed, immature brain. And then as you get older, your brain gets so good and it ripens and it becomes just a firing mechanism that you love. And as you get older, it gets better and better. I'm so lucky that's happening with me. But the body goes, oh. So that's, you know, a big cosmic joke on us all. But as long as I have energy and my brain is still working, which it is, I'm going to keep doing this. We can't let this activity stop in our community. It's too valuable. It's so much a part of who we are here in Fairbanks. And I know it's just a little town, but that's all we have, is our little town. So I'm going to serve as long as I can.
Well, Peggy McDonald Ferguson, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Robert.
A link to Fairbanks Drama Association is on the Northern Soundings page. It's Pledge Week on KUAC. You can find out more by going to KUAC.org. When we return from the break, Nature's Mirror. Welcome back. In Shakespeare's Hamlet, the eponymous prince exhorts traveling actors to hold, as it were, a mirror up to nature. In other words, reflect truth to playgoers. Fairbanks is lucky to have several playwrights to help do this. Perhaps no one more celebrated than Anne Hanley. Anne is a former state writer laureate, and one of her most celebrated works is a play involving the late native elder Sidney Huntington. I spoke with Anne 2 years ago about her work, and for this special edition of Northern Soundings, I thought I would revisit it, especially in light of Peggy Ferguson's remarks about Anne. In this conversation, I asked Anne what inspired her subjects.
I don't have a lot of good ideas for plays. I have a lot of bad ideas. And then I spend a little time with them, and I realize I don't want to spend 2 years on this. You know, I don't want to spend my essence on this. But there's a few that just won't leave me alone. And, you know, those are the ones that have the questions that I need answers to. Because otherwise, why do it, you know?
Mm-hmm. You put it on the page. Then you need a director, an art director, a cast, a venue that can bring it alive. And it is so dependent on so many people's to that realization.
Yes, but that's the wonder of it. Any one of those people can sabotage it. And, you know, a director can really sabotage it. But on the other hand, they can all bring wonderful things that you never thought of, but that you get credit for because they find them. I know in my last play, The Winter Bear, which I've been fortunate enough to be able to produce and see many times, which is a great blessing for a playwright. The last director, Tom Robinault, put a shelf in the scene, and he put a coffee can in the shelf and several other items that were referred to in the play. And that coffee can became a real focus and became a place where there was a lot of business done, you know, stage business. And I had never thought about it, and it was so simple and it was so perfect. When I saw it, I went, yes. And he brought that. He brought that insight. And I find that all the directors that I've worked with have brought their own kind of magic and their own kind of genius to what they do.
In acting, it's often said that it's harder to act comedy than tragedy. Mm-hmm. How about writing? You have a wonderful sense of humor, and so many of your pieces bring that out. Where do you naturally go as a writer?
Well, I always have to watch out for my humor because it can be cynical, and it can also be easy and clever. And I feel that when I was younger, I would often use it and be clever. And I don't want to be clever anymore. I want to find the words under the words. Often, you know, humor is a good tool to do that. I just have to be really careful with myself that I don't get carried away.
Did you ever think of going into acting, or was writing always the focus for you?
I was always a writer. Acting, I have so much respect for actors. You know, they have to work on themselves constantly. They have to reveal themselves. And I always try to be really careful of the actors that I'm working with. You know, you don't ask them to do things that they can't do or they don't want to do, or you don't put them with people that might let them down. And most of the actors I know are, many of them are very shy. You just feel like, whoa, they're up on stage and they can just talk anywhere to anybody, but that's not the case. Oftentimes they go into acting to deal with that.
One of the interesting things, I think, for any playwright is the way that cinema has dominated the dramatic experience for most Americans. What's your take on that, Anne? Does it make it harder for playwrights, for live theater, or does that develop an appetite and so people may be more receptive to live theater?
I think both. Some things are plays and some things are screenplays. And it has to do with sort of the structure of the story. You know, a screenplay is episodic and, you know, one scene is in a studio and the next scene is on Mars and then the next scene is in the Vatican. You know, you can, it doesn't have that being tied to place like a play does. But a play sort of explodes from one situation and, you know, one group of people in a room together and goes from there. So other things are plays. And a theater is maybe, to my mind, a more sacred space because it's a place where you can get up and discuss problems that are happening in society or within the human psyche, and you can say or do almost anything. Whereas sometimes I feel like films have more constraints because they have to pull in an audience.
Having done both, which do you prefer, or does it depend on, as you say, the subject?
I think it depends on the subject. It's like children, you know, some you give music lessons to, and, you know, some you push on a soccer field. And I kind of like to just sort of think of it that way, that what does this story need?
Many of your plays tackle deeper themes. Sunset Clause comes to mind about the elderly and their life. Tell me how that play in particular came about.
Well, I call that play Romeo and Juliet in a Rest Home. And instead of the parents trying to keep the kids apart, it's the kids trying to keep the parents apart. But that came because my mother was in such a, you know, quote, rehabilitation center. And she was dying, and they persisted in trying to make her do crafts. And, you know, I'd come in, and there'd be a hat on her head, and there'd be an instrument in her lap. And there was not as much dignity as I thought there should have been, or I think that she should have just been left alone to die. And no one would ever admit that that's what was going on. So I found it a very artificial and taxing situation. I remember one time I came in, and my mother was sitting there with this huge, heavy fork that they'd given her to eat with. And she couldn't even lift it because she was so weak. So I bought her a little plastic kid spoon. And a nurse came in and was just furious with me because that was dangerous. It needed to be a weighted spoon. You know, she could choke on that little spoon. And so I ended up like sneaking it in when I'd come. And then, you know, I'd kind of feed her and, you know, let her lift that spoon. But the whole thing was like that. It was very nonsensical. I mean, you could see where all the rules came from, but often in their execution, they were ridiculous.
And we have such a remote experience on death now in our culture. It used to be that people died in their homes and the family would know, have that part of the human experience quite intimately in their own homes. That's not the case anymore.
No. And, you know, my mother was in this place because none of her children could take care of her at that point. So I think the people there did the best they could, but they weren't family, and they had a different goal. You know, they were rehabilitating right till the end.
How do performances then guide you into the rewriting process? What do you see in that, and you decide, okay, this is what I'm going to change?
The wonderful thing that a playwright has is an audience. And the audience is your arbiter. And if they don't laugh at the jokes, or they laugh inappropriately at the jokes, or they don't get something, or they're fidgeting, or whatever, you know it. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. And so that is so much better than sitting in front of a computer looking at a script. And until you're out there and you do that, you can do readings, and they're helpful. I mean, everybody is an audience. So if you have four people and you do a reading of the script, that's going to help. But you have to get it on its feet. And I've been involved with the 8x10 at Fairbanks Drama for a number of years. And, you know, sometimes we have playwrights who will, like, turn in a script that's too long or too wordy. And, you know, we kind of try to tell them, maybe you'd like to work with this. But oh no, it has to be. Every single word has to be. And then you see them come out after they've heard it for the first time and say, can I cut three pages? I mean, it's just like walking up to a guillotine. There's just no ifs, ands, or buts that you're going to get the truth from an audience.
You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm replaying a discussion I had 2 years ago with the playwright Ann Hanley. Fairbanks Theater is only made possible by support from community members, just as public broadcasting is made possible by listeners like you. It's Pledge Week at KUAC. Go to KUAC.org to find out more. When we return, stories sparking more stories. Welcome back. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This episode, I'm replaying a discussion I had 2 years ago with the playwright and former writer laureate, Anne Hanley. Her Winter Bear project was inspired in part by the late Native elder Sidney Huntington, and it toured Alaska. I asked about the origins of the work.
I had a wonderful opportunity that was given to me by three young men in their 20s to write a play about Sidney Huntington. They'd gotten a little grant, and it was at a time when there'd been a number of suicides of young people in villages, and everyone was quite upset about it, including these young men, and they wanted to do something. So they did dances and they did rap, and one of them came up with the idea of a play, which was interesting because, you know, I don't think that was a lot in their experience. And I heard them talking about it on the radio, and I called up, and, you know, they said that it was going to be about Sidney Huntington. And I said, well, who's going to write it? And they said, well, we'll all write it. And I said, give me a crack at that, because that Sidney Huntington's book is just the one that I recommend to anybody. Yes, yeah, that wants to know about what the real Alaska was like. So, you know, the chance to do that was incredible. And I, you know, I kept looking at his life and thinking, you know, how am I going to not come out with like a Hallmark Hall of Fame sort of drama about he did this and he did that. And then he went to dog mushing, and then he, you know, started a fish processing plant. And I came up with the constant that he was always giving advice to young people. So I created a fictional young person in a particular time, you know, very late in Sidney's life. And the boy added a difficult childhood, was thinking about suicide. And, you know, once I put Sidney together with that fictional boy, that was my key. You know, I'm always looking for a way into a story. And that was my way into Sidney's story, because I could reveal a lot about Sidney himself, although the main character is the boy.
Mm-hmm. And spoiler alert, there's a very traditional act the boy has to go through in order to mature, which goes back mythologically or sociologically to the very roots of human experience, not just Alaska Native experience, but where we all mm-hmm. come from.
I kept realizing, you know, in little ways, it didn't come to me all at once, is that this boy, this young Alaska Native boy, who is pretty clueless about a lot of things, is in a sense a very classic hero. And his story is a hero myth, that he's called upon to hunt and to kill the winter bear. And he's has to do it because of circumstances, with nothing but the kind of primitive weapon that had been used for, I don't know, generations and maybe hundreds of years by his ancestors.
And it's been so well received. And I want you to talk a little bit about taking it on the road.
It's wonderful. We perform, our favorite shows, I think, are in villages. And we've performed in 39 communities, all the way from Anchorage down to Manly Hot Springs, you know, where it was about as big as a garage. And we love to do the shows in villages, because the people appreciate that it's about them. You know, we were right down there, kind of cheek to jowl with the audience. And we've had a number of actors, very good actors, who are used to performing for audiences, large audiences, and used to being in film. And they were kind of like, well, you know, this is going to be kind of a podunk kind of thing to do. And, you know, they would say to me, oh, my God, you know, this person came up to me afterwards and brought me salmon strips or a piece of fur, or told me their story. And they realize that this is more than an exercise. Sometimes when you're going through putting a play together, it's all the sum of all the parts. You have to think about the costumes and the sound and the lighting, and you've heard the jokes so many times, they're not funny. And then you hear someone laughing uproariously, and it just brings you back, like, whoa, we're really doing something here. And it matters to them. It matters to their lives. And oftentimes we have, especially men, who'll kind of like after the theater empties out, there'll be a big Ford pickup outside kind of revving the engine, and a gentleman will come in and say, "That's me, you know, that's my life," and tell us his story. And that sharing of the stories is so humbling, because people's stories are so much more incredible than what I wrote. And when I see the things that people have forgiven in their lives, I'm just astounded. And I just learned so much from that.
Mm. You were the first playwright that was named as the Alaska State Writer Laureate, who's a playwright. What did it mean for you to be the Writer Laureate?
Well, it was a great thing, and I don't think there's been another playwright, and I would like to see that rectified, because we have some amazing playwrights in Alaska now. But it was a lot of fun. I decided I was going to try to really do something active, so I did write a column on Alaska writers for a number of years for the News Miner and the Anchorage Daily News, and I think it was in the Juneau Empire also. And that allowed me to do what you're doing to me, which is, you know, call up writers and sit down and say, tell me about yourself. Tell me what makes you do this. And I loved it. It was wonderful.
Mm. Do you see yourself now as a mentor for a new generation of playwrights? Do you encourage?
Well, I try to. Fairbanks is a little bit isolated. I know there's several really active playwriting groups in Anchorage, and at the moment we don't have one going here, but at times we have, and that's always great for me. I would hope that I can do more. I'd like to do more, and it's fun.
What's ahead? What project are you looking for now?
Well, I'm looking into doing a project on the response of the community of Fairbanks to the Fairbanks 4, I don't know what to call it, situation as it evolved over the last 19 years. I'm not so much interested in the case itself as I am in people's reaction to it, because I was here and I lived through that time, and I know I'm a different person than I was then, and I'd like to explore the idea with other people and see what they think.
Well, Anne Hanley, I look forward to more stories from you. Thank you for coming on.
Great. Well, thank you. It was fun.
Links to Anne's work are on the Northern Soundings website. Up ahead, Breaking Legs and Stealing the Limelight on Cachexit Clippings. Besides entertaining and inspiring audiences, it turns out the theater is a fertile place for language. Here's Chris Lott and Cachexit Clippings to explain.
Just before my first time going on stage, a teacher told me to break a leg. I was so surprised at this seemingly cruel advice that I almost tripped over my own feet and did exactly that. Luckily, it had no effect on my face-painted performance lip-syncing AC/DC's Back in Black, and fortunately for everyone, that also proved to be both the first and last time I was on stage to do anything resembling acting. But the phrase break a leg stuck with me, and proved to be just one of many linguistic treats I'd later learn from my board-trotting, theater-loving friends in college. The bone-breaking advice that threatened to put me off my metal impersonation, a theatrically flamboyant way of saying good luck, because in that world, actually wishing good luck is thought to bring bad luck, is of unknown origin, but sometimes that makes for even better folk etymologies. Interesting and unfounded explanations for break a leg include that it comes from the exploits of John Wilkes Booth, who broke his leg jumping onto the stage after shooting President Lincoln, though how this would inspire good luck is beyond me. That it reflects the sentiments of understudies who might hope the principals would be incapacitated, allowing them to take the stage, or that it goes back to Shakespeare's time when bowing, bending at the knee, was called breaking a leg. While these explanations are colorful and occasionally scary, the one I find most plausible is that it is an adaptation of the German phrase Hals und Beinbruch, which literally means leg and neck fracture, used by German pilots in the First World War to wish each other well before a sortie. This use might be doubly ironic if speculation about its origins are true. Some historians believe the phrase came to German through Yiddish from the Hebrew, and forgive my pronunciation, Hatzlaka Ubraka, which I'm told has a similar pronunciation to the German phrase, but means the quite different success and blessing. What a word or phrase means is ultimately the important thing, but speculation about their beginnings can still be entertaining. The Green Room, where actors wait to break their legs, is first recorded in 1678, but it's unclear if it was based on a corruption of scene, as in a behind-the-scene room, or take your pick from at least a dozen theories, including the walls of the room being covered with green baize material to protect the best actors' clothing, being the storage area for artificial grass or shrubbery, or even referencing the complexion of actors preparing to go on stage, whether due to nerves or to their makeup still setting. The origins of chewing the scenery, to overact melodramatically, putting the ham in Hamlet, as they say, is as disputed as what merits the description. The phrase is often attributed to a Dorothy Parker review from the 1930s, where she described an actor as more glutton than artist, who commenced to chew up the scenery. And while that may have popularized the image that has become a cliché today, earlier sightings in print date back at least 50 years before. However it was invented, the world's favorite description of William Shatner's acting style remains somewhat mysterious. Why chewing the scenery? The best I can do is to share the late Evan Morris, aka the Word Detective's, explanation that an overly dramatic actor's fervid antics might well have been metaphorically likened to seizing and biting pieces of the painted scenic backdrop. Many other commonly used words and phrases emerged from the theater world. Backstage is obvious, both literally and metaphorically. But to upstage someone, as when Alison Bechdel observes in her graphic novel Funhouse that she was upstaged, demoted from protagonist in her own drama to comic relief in her parents' tragedy, goes back to early theaters in which the stage was angled so that actors who were the focus of the scene would literally move upstage to get more attention. Actors doing that upstaging likely seek the limelight, referring to an old form of stage lighting produced by burning quicklime. While that primitive lighting mechanism has yielded to progress, the figurative limelight remains, along with no end of actors, politicians, artists, and influencers seeking it, as do limes, the crew who operate moving spotlights during a production. When we do something by the book, we are doing it according to the written rules, aka the book, and naturally off the books is to break the rules. But in the theater, being off book is a good thing, referring to the point in rehearsals when actors no longer need to carry scripts around and can perform from memory, ready for the real performance. Being off book is necessary for the audience to enter the imaginary world created on stage, but before that, it is essential that none of the cast or crew break curtain, whether that be literally peeking out through the curtain, recognizing an audience member in some way during a performance, or being seen in costume offstage. Finally, no tour of theater jargon would be complete without a quick consideration of theater superstitions. Thespians and their directors may not be the most superstitious group in the world, but they have to rank rather highly. In addition to breaking a leg, theater folk can get sometimes seriously exercised if some superstitious taboos are broken. Never uttering the title of the Scottish play is a well-known example, but to that you can add a few more, such as no whistling, said to date back to the days when sailors often served as theatrical crew, handling the rigging, ropes, and booms while communicating with coded whistles, so other whistling could lead to accident or injury. No real money, jewelry, mirrors, or peacock feathers on stage. The prohibition against money and jewelry presumably reduces the temptation of thievery, while mirrors interfere with the lighting, and there must be some intersection with more traditional superstitions about mirrors. And peacock feathers display an evil eye blamed for many a theatrical mishap. And finally, the ghost light, a light left on upstage when no one is in the theater that practically keeps people from inadvertently walking off the stage or tripping over items on the set in the dark, but also wards off the various ghosts supposed to haunt theaters going all the way back to the shade of Thespis, the first ancient Greek actor. For more on theater jargon, including the Australian equivalent of breaking a leg, but with chickens, killing it, figuratively, and going tops and tails and queue to queue, direct your favorite browser to catexic.com/KUAC.
That's it for this special edition of Northern Soundings. I hope you'll join me next time as I talk with Alaskans about their passions. See you then.